Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of What's Up With History. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the famous order of warrior monks known as the Knights Templar. Now, my source, as I usually mention, is the book The Templars, A Secret History Revealed, written by Barbara Frail, Secret Vatican Archives Historian. Now, the order of the Knights Templar matched most European kingdoms in military might, influence, and economic power, matched the kingdoms themselves. The outcome of the order was discovered by none other than Barbara Frail in what we know as the Chinon Parchment. Now, the Chinon Parchment describes the interrogation of Grand Master Jacques de Molay and others in Chinon Castle by order of Pope Clement V. Now, they were accused of heresy by King Philip IV of France. That's why they needed to be interrogated in the first place. Now, a little bit of backstory as to how the order came about. What was the need for such an order? The Crusaders were called to arms by Pope Urban II, who was very diplomatic and eloquent, in the Council of Clermont in 1095. Now, the Crusades provided opportunities for everyone, whether it be financial gains or status or religion, as in they were ensured access to heaven when they died, which was very appealing to people at these times. Now, many were gathered by a man named Peter the Hermit. And King Baldwin I of Jerusalem, he needed troops and citizens to maintain the Christian foothold that these crusaders had made in the Middle East. And in order to do that, they needed troops. So they found troops in the Knights under a man named Hugh de Payens in Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is now known as Temple Mount, or the Holy Sepulchre. Payens and others took three vows in 1120 of chastity, poverty, and obedience under Baldwin II and the Patriarch Garmond of Picquigny. Now, the Brotherhood was designated the Knights of the Temple of Solomon, or as we know, the Knights Templar. Now, Hugh de Payens, the first Grand Master, needed to take on administrative and military responsibilities formerly denounced by him. He went to the Middle East, he went to the Al-Aqsa Mosque as a way of becoming a monk and renouncing his layman knighthood. But now that he's the head of this order, he needs to sort of get back into the swing of things, which at first was probably uncomfortable for him, but after a while he realized he, in his mind, had a higher calling that he needed to attend to. Now, as a side note, the Order of the Knights Hospitaller of St. John was founded in 1113 to care for the sick. It's like the hospital for the Order of the Knights Templar. They'll come up later in the story as a key component. Now, Payens traveled throughout Europe, gaining followers via his many political connections, and the order answered only to the Pope so as to maintain the order's focus in the Holy Land, so as not to fall into secular sort of flights of fancy at the time. Now, the church was being threatened by a schism at this time, between around 1120 and 1127 when Payens heads west, and there were questions of just war and legitimacy of force at this time. Did they really need an order of warrior monks to maintain control over their foothold in the East? Did they really need violence in order to protect Christianity at the time? And the person who helped clarify these things was known as Bernard of Clairvaux. He's a lot like Urban II in that he was very diplomatic and very eloquent in the way he spoke and wrote. So they chose him as the spokesman of the order. They were doubtful of reconciliation between knighthood and monastic life at first, but he used what was known as Cistercian monasticism, which committed to Christianize secular customs, and this was a key component to making the order functional in its rules and code of conduct. And the order finally achieves papal recognition at the Council of Troyes in January 1129 under Pope Honorius II. Now, the model of the Holy Warrior was delineated in 1135 and 37 in Bernard's In Praise of the New Knighthood, and conditions for the order's growth were laid out in Innocent II's Every Perfect Gift. Now, the code employed aristocratic ethics of physical strength, courage with honor, loyalty to the group, and the spirit of sacrifice, which is what the Red Cross on their uniforms symbolizes. It symbolizes martyrdom, a sense of self-sacrifice for the greater good. And their appearance needed to inspire just measure and dignity. Now, the Templars were outfitted with basic armor and weapons, and the seal of the two knights on one horse symbolizes the duality of the Templars of being very dignified individuals and warriors, but also very poor. And not poor in the sense of, like, money, like we think of, but poor in the sense of humbleness, I guess. Humility, that's the word, yeah. humility in spirituality. And that was also meant to inhibit individualism in a way, sort of to make a cohesion of the troops, which was enforced by the history of lay knighthood with most of these individuals. The first people that they recruited were only knights. They could only have knights for this position because only knights were suitable for us. They were the only ones who actually had military-ish training. So their regulations were formalized in 1163, and it was made up of an executive council that headed off the entire order, which was made up of the Grand Master, his companions, the ancients, which were just very old and veteran-like Templars at the time, and the general staff. Now, the Seneschal was the second in command, and the estate was managed by the treasurer, and it was a big estate. Each province stretched from Portugal to Armenia and Scotland to Jerusalem, and were run by provincial masters, which is why they had to come up with the term Grand Master for the head of the entire order, because they needed masters in each province. So in order to sign a court of... can't talk. In order to prevent any confusion, they changed the names a bit. Now, serious growth was apparent in the 12th century due to French records, and it was designated as the church's bank in the 13th century. Now, most of their work was focused in what is known as the Outer Mirror. Now, the Outer Mirror is just an area in the Middle East that was sort of the front lines of the Crusades at the time. Now, the Muslims, which were the enemy in this war, they didn't view war as a religious issue, but more of a protection of their territories, which led to some partnerships between the Templars and the Muslims at times, which, again, shows a very elastic mindset of the Templars. They were very forward-thinking in how they dealt with diplomacy, and they were very flexible with their ways around succeeding in their mission, because most of the battles weren't fought on the field, but at the negotiating table. Now, Outremer, like I said, was a Christian-controlled area in Syria and Palestine, split into about four states, known as the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the County of Tripoli, the Principality of Antioch, and the County of Edessa. Now, the Crusaders, the Knights Templar, distinguished themselves in the Second Crusade despite failure, and they suffered their greatest loss to Saladin at the Horns of Hattin, which was a massacre showing immense hatred and fear on Saladin's part, which spread rumors throughout the entire world. Now, the loss of Jerusalem to Muslim forces showed a failure on the order's part, which was kind of an issue for them in terms of popularity, but records show that they didn't exactly lose any donations or any support or members joining. Now, they needed new members because of the immense losses that they had in the Second Crusade, and so that led to the acceptance of formerly excommunicated knights to exemplify forgiveness on the part of the order. And they also began accepting more lay individuals and people who weren't knights at the time. And in the meantime, while they did not have control over Jerusalem, the order begins sort of a reconstruction. They eventually take part in what were known as the Secular Crusades, which began with about the Third Crusade, where with the French and Venetians in the sack of Zara in the 13th century, which, if you remember from my last episode, I mentioned. Now, the same fate of failure was in the Fourth Crusade, and the Fifth Crusade actually succeeded, ironically, under an excommunicated emperor, Frederick II, who reclaimed the Holy Land for about 10 years due to negotiating. Now, a book, The History of Outremer, by William of Tyre in 1173, applauded the first Templars, but reprimanded the current ones, and this book became very popular and sort of started this wildfire of rumors of the modern Templars sort of losing their touch on things, more or less. And the golden age of the Templars was swiftly coming to an end after this book came out. Now, the Templars and Hospitallers unwisely took part in dynastic wars between secular kings, and most argue that the decay began because of a lack of combat on the front lines in the Outer Mirror. So they ended up taking part in these other sort of little disputes between kings and kingdoms and other sort of aristocratic scandals, and that didn't help anybody. Now, Pope Boniface VIII's papacy was threatened by the crimes listed in the Manifesto of Lunghezza, after the Kelowna theft, which the church was suffering a bit. It had lost a lot of money due to the Crusades. So Pope Boniface took out a loan, but it was stolen on the way by the Kelowna family. And in order to protect themselves, they came up with this Manifesto of Lunghese, which brought up all these different heretical issues that Pope Boniface had done. And so that kind of gained popularity at the time. It didn't affect him in his lifetime, however. But the separation of church and state was another issue that came up by Philip the Fair as superiorum non recognoscens. And he targeted Boniface specifically with this. He took the side of the Kelowna family in this dispute and saw it as a way of increasing his own interests and trying to gain more of a foothold and authority in his own kingdom. Because the church, any Catholic kingdom around the area, was at the mercy of the Catholic Church at the time. Now, the Templars no longer served as protectors of the Holy Land, but remained supporters of the papacy in the meantime, so they were on the side of the Pope at this time. And the Bishop Bernard Cisse, who was executed against the Pope's authority because he made accusations against the king, which were pretty much accurate at the time, of him slacking off from his job, and that was just another nail in the coffin at the time. Now, the members of the order shifted from aristocracy to bourgeois sort of families, alongside the shift from combatants to more accountants at the time. They were focusing more on their headquarters in the West. There were two poles of power, which appeared on the front in Cyprus and the administrative heart in France at the time. And that's where they sort of focused their efforts at this time, because the Holy Land is gone. Now, election for a new Grandmaster fell between Jacques de Molay and Hugh de Perrade. Now, Molay was more fit, but Perrade aligned with more Western interests. However, Molay won. So, Perrade was left as plenipotentiary, while Jacques de Molay left to do some business in Cyprus. And a plenipotentiary is just the Grandmaster in charge when the real Grandmaster is gone. And he signed the indictment against the Pope. Now, the theory is that he was forced by the king, but it was still a massive mistake on the part of the order. And rumors began to spread about the order and reached the ears of Pope Clement V. Now, France's gold at the time was in crowns. It was reduced due to war costs in 1306 with England, and a theory suggests that the king became obsessed after seeing the Templars' treasury. He saw all the gold that they had, and he decided he wanted it for himself. So he concocted some plan that we'll soon see work out against the Templar order. Now, there was a loan granted to the king by Jean de La Tour against authority of Grand Master, and he was expelled from the temple, but he was most likely acting on authority of Perrade, who was plenipotentiary at the time, so he had the authority of the Grand Master. He was eventually reinstated due to the demands of both King Philip IV and Pope Clement V against the wishes of Molay. And the suspicion of the Pope was revealed when the rule of the order was asked to be provided to the Curia in writing. He wanted Molay to present this code as a means of the Curia trying to find out whether or not these rumors that he had been hearing at the time pop up were true. Now, the prosecution of the order finally was assembled while the Pope was having treatments for a few months, and a lot of things came to light in the interrogations and trials of the order. There was a ritual revealed of spitting on the cross, which was revealed by Perrade to the lawyers in the Council of France, and this shocked the entire world, that this Catholic order was having a ritual done for new recruits where they had to spit on the cross. However, there is a reason behind it that I will get to in a moment. The initial indictment targeted to get rid of Molay mainly, and possibly put Perrade in power, because like I said, he aligned more with the Western powers. And Guillaume de Paris was misled into thinking he was indicting only a few members. Instead, all the Templars were arrested and interrogated on the morning of October 3rd, 1307. Now, most documents surrounding the trial are tampered with, but it's still a treasure trove of information. The test revealed in the code was meant to be a test for new candidates, like the spitting on the cross that I mentioned, but it wasn't clarified in the code. So, absolute obedience was the biggest component. Absolute obedience to the immediate Superior was the biggest component of new recruits. So we're led to believe that the spitting on the cross was a test to see whether or not you would actually do the extreme that your superior asked of you, which makes sense in a way, but it's, in my opinion, kind of a roundabout way to do it. But nevertheless, this test was meant to gauge the recruit's response, like I mentioned, and the Templar qualities could be revealed in this moment, whether or not he was actually capable of doing what a Templar needed to do in battle. Now, extraneous elements were added later, such as idol worship and cultish veneration of the sacred blood, which led to more rumors about the Holy Grail at the time. And the king eventually placed himself above the church in his country by arresting these Templars. He took authority over his domain without any regard to the religious institution that he claimed his kingdom was under. Now, the majority of the confessions in 1307 were due to an alleged written confession by Molay, and the pillaging of the Templar estates were halted by papal custody of those estates. So, things were moving pretty fast at this time. Now, the legates Berenger Fridolin and Etienne de Suisse were granted the ability to excommunicate Philip if they were unable to see the Templar leaders. So, obviously, they were allowed to see him, because Philip didn't want to be excommunicated. So Molay finally testified to the envoys on December 27, 1307. And there was a prearranged counter by the Templars, which indicates possible communication between prisoners. And this worked hand in hand with what the legates were trying to get out of Molay, which was a confession and absolution. And hopefully that would help the Templars become innocent of their charges and let go. Now, on the way to Rome, the caravan of the Templar officials sent to the Pope in order to be interrogated again, because they only got to talk to Molay, but they wanted to talk to the others, who were also in the executive council. The caravan split, and the highest ranking stopped at Chinon Castle, which, as you hopefully remember, is what the Chinon Parchment was named after. Now, Clement's ultimate goal was to reform the order and combine it with the Hospitallers. Now, he wanted to do this because he wanted the order to survive. He wanted it to maintain its support of the papacy at the time, because he needed that support. And so, sadly, that doesn't actually happen. Now, Clement issues the papal bull granting forgiveness to call for a council in 2 years to discuss a new crusade and the solution for the Templars. And in the meantime, Philip left Poitiers for the holidays, so the legates Berenger Fridolin, Etienne de Suisse, and Landolfo Brancacci head to Chinon, and they are plenipotentiaries to hold the inquest. And, ergo, we have the Chinon Parchment, which details the absolution of the leaders. Now, the use of the plenipotentiaries and release of the papal bull negated any possible moves by the king. However, the king eventually does succeed in the defamation of Boniface, and this in turn beats the Pope down. He's sick, he's old, he's getting tired of this back and forth with the king. He eventually just gives up on the order. So he surrenders the order, abandons them, and he does this in order to avoid another schism within the church. So you can see kind of the issue that he was dealing with at the time, and you can understand his decision on this part, but the order did not like it at all, obviously. So he dissolved the order on March 22nd, 1312, with the papal bull, a voice from on high. And Molay and others were refused access to each other, nor the Pope. Molay and Geoffrey de Charny were burned at the stake on the Seine on March 18th, 1314. They were tried, found guilty, and burned at the stake. And both Pope and King, actually, died within months of Molay, leading to superstition about his curse that he placed on them, which a lot of people to this day believe to be true, because it's kind of a strong coincidence that they both died within months, but hey, maybe that's just a coincidence. However, that does conclude the story of the Knights Templar. We have a few people nowadays trying to revive the order and make it a popular thing in America, at least. However, it's not going to be the same as the order that we know of in history. And there's still a lot of things that we don't know about the order. There's another interesting fact that they were granted sole judgment over the validity of religious artifacts within the church. So that again leads to more conspiracies about the Holy Grail or the Shroud of Turin and all those artifacts' validity. So that's more food for thought for you all to toy with in the meantime. Now, definitely go check out the book. It's got way more information than I gave in this episode. I just kind of glazed over the highlights a bit just to get the information out there and get people interested in it. And I hope it was interesting for you guys. Definitely give me any feedback on anything you guys think I can do differently or do better. And next episode is going to be a little bit different from this one than my usual. I've got kind of a new schedule that I'm trying to work up with on these. Hopefully you guys like it. I'm going to try to keep it interesting. It's just, it takes a while to read a book, obviously. So, nevertheless, be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter at JTPepper02. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I definitely enjoyed telling you all this fun story and interesting history. So, thank you so much. Have a good one.